belief that Moe's chowder is overrated.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to day two of the December legislative days. This is the House Interim Committee on Economic Development and Trade, and today is Thursday, the 13th of December. So happy early December, happy holidays, season's greetings to everyone here. I noticed we have a full agenda and a full room. Very happy to see that. Today. We are going to be conducting, colleagues, an informational meeting, which is going to cover urban renewal, Oregon Broadband Advisory Council, an update on wine labeling issues, and the Eastern Oregon Border Development Region Board. And then we're going to go into a work session. We are actually going to be introducing some measures. For anybody who may be listening to our hearing online today, I'll remind you that that while the legislature is not in session here in Oregon, that we do use these periodic legislative days to review issues that we contemplate may be the subject of legislation in the coming months when we do convene the session. And we also consider bills that the committee may be prepared to introduce. We'll be looking at about a dozen of those later today. So I'm going to go ahead and open the information meeting. And I am going to take the chair's prerogative to adjust the schedule a little bit, and I am going to lead off with the wine labeling update. And I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Smith, because I'm going to be presenting from the witness stand, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you.
Together with Mr. Marks and Mr. Berno, if they'd like to come and join me. Good morning, Chair Brock Smith, members of the committee. For your record, as you know, I am David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast, and I'm very pleased to be back with you today to provide an update on a subject that we talked about at our last meeting, which is the subject of wine labeling and the Oregon wine industry. And we want to give you a little bit of detail on what has evolved since our last meeting, and then talk in a bit more detail about some potential legislation that we can use to address some of the subjects that we are, in fact, considering. But Mr. Chairman, before I do that, as I always do on this topic, I want to make a disclosure, and that is that I am indeed a shareholder in an Oregon winery. The winery that I own shares in fact, has 17,000 shareholders. And I actually went to the point of checking with my spouse to find out how much money we have invested. I find that we have invested $6,280. That is the extent of our investment in that winery. But I wanted to put that on the record, as I always do, and to explain for anybody that might be listening that here in Oregon, we have a citizen legislature. A citizen legislature where legislators are expected to have other sources of income and is expected to participate in discussions where they may have some professional or experiential expertise. And in fact, here in Oregon are required to vote even when we disclose a potential or a real conflict of interest. I think that's an important point to make in these conversations. So, Mr. Chairman, colleagues, when last we met, I detailed for you that the very best-selling Oregon Pinot in the country, priced at over $17, is the Oregon Coast Pinot Noir. Except, of course, that we are not producing any Pinot Noir on the Oregon coast. And what we learned on further consideration and is that this wine is made not in Oregon, but close to Lodi, California, by a large company called Copper Cane LLC. So we came to you and detailed that, and what has happened since our last meeting? Well, the first thing that happened, Mr. Chairman, is within days of our last meeting, Copper Cane canceled their wine grape contracts in Southern Oregon, canceled their contracts in the Rogue Valley on the pretense of smoke taint. that the fires had impacted the quality of the grapes. Some people suggested that might be retaliation for our conversations. Other people looked deeper and said there was evidence that perhaps Copper Cane was over-inventoried and looking for some pretense to reduce their grape purchases. But one way or the other, the impact was significant. The impact was that 2,000 tons of grape purchases were canceled in Southern Oregon, a total contracts valued at roughly $4 million in an area already decimated by the summer fire season. And in response to that, something quite remarkable happened, and that is the Oregon wine industry stepped up. They looked at the grapes. They said, the grapes are fine. We're going to buy them, and we're going to make wine out of those same grapes. We're going to buy them at the rate that was originally contracted by Copper Cane, and we are going to produce what we call the Solidarity Vintage. And the Solidarity Vintage should be available before we adjourn in 2019, nice. And all the proceeds of the Solidarity Vintage will be used to support those grape growers in Southern Oregon. It's a remarkable example of how Oregons step up and stand together in the face of adversity, and I'm really very proud of what our Oregon wine industry has done. Now, within days of that action, at the urging of our federal congressional delegation, the Alcohol and Tobacco Bureau of Tax and Trade took steps and said that Copper Cane could no longer use seven of their wine labels. They ordered the surrender of seven wine labels that were currently in use. And I'll come back to this fascinating federal action in just a minute, because just days after that federal action, here in Oregon, the OLCC took additional steps. And they issued an order rescinding the license of Copper Cane to wholesale and to ship their products into the state of Oregon. And they, in that order, pending the possibility of a hearing of review if Copper Cane should contest that decision, they determined the revocation was based on seven detailed violations, including wrongly citing multiple AVA origins, improper use of geographic product names, false and misleading information on cartons and labels, and failure to meet requirements for claiming specific Oregon appellations. Copper Cane cannot wholesale, cannot ship their product into the state of Oregon based on this order, which is quite unprecedented within our state for the agency to take this kind of action. So the federal government has stepped up and said, quit using these bad labels. The state of Oregon has said, you've made a number of fraudulent and unlawful errors, and we're not going to let you wholesale or ship your product into the state of Oregon. It would seem that things are going in a positive direction. But I wanted to come back to the federal action, because while they said you can't use these bad labels anymore, they also said that we're going to give you an allowance to use up the product that is already in the marketplace. They're going to use up the bottles that have already been labeled or ready to ship or have been shipped. And our research indicates that totals nearly 1 million bottles. 1 million bottles that are being distributed nationally. Let me try and put that in context for you. 1 million bottles is comparable to the average production of an Oregon winery over the course of 15 years. 15 years of production for an average Oregon winery. And we can only begin to contemplate what the impact will be on Oregon's market share and Oregon's marketing of our own in-state produced products with 1 million bottles in circulation, and how many years it will take to clear those out, which is why the Oregon winemakers have already petitioned TTB to re-examine that decision and to ask that those bottles be recalled and relabeled. Well, what's been transpiring during this process? First of all, you know, I came to you during our last meeting, and I showed you the marketing materials. I'm not trying to block the rest of you in here. I showed you these marketing materials that I originally encountered, and this is the 2015 Oregon Coast Pinot Noir. And now we have all these decisions saying the labeling's bad, the marketing's bad, you can't ship, you've got to make changes. And in response to that, we see the 2016 vintage, which is being marketed now. And I would say that that Copper Cane has doubled down. They have doubled down. And what are they saying about this? Copper Cane says that their marketing is simply a fanciful effort to communicate how they are making grapes. I think the state of Oregon has said quite clearly that they have gone beyond fanciful and are now acting in a fraudulent way. Copper Cane was quoted in Forbes magazine saying, our wines are in compliance. Our labels are in compliance, and we will continue to sell them and make consumers happy. Our wines are in compliance, our labels are in compliance. When the OLCC based their suspension decision on, and I'm quoting here, the volume of the sales of unlawful products sold within the state of Oregon and the number of violations committed by Copper Cane, which indicate a disregard for the law. A disregard for the law, colleagues. But I think the central question that remains is whether these marketing materials are designed to truthfully communicate that someone is buying Oregon grapes, taking them out of state, and making wine with them, or whether they are intended to confuse and defraud consumers with the mistaken belief that they are purchasing a product from Oregon grapes made into wine in Oregon. Now, I'm not going to answer that question for you. I am going to invite the owner of Copper Cane LLC to answer the question of what their intention is with these marketing materials. And I'm going to present to you a recent interview on ABC television. If you could just click on the play button down in the lower left-hand corner there. Just click play.
Tell us about this rosé.
Well, rosé is the hot thing right now, obviously.
Really?
It's taken a while. You know, there was the white Zin craze, but the Provence rosé is the real dry, kind of stark, very traditional style of rosé.
Okay.
Has just recently become a very popular style. Are farming and producing wines out of Oregon.
And it's you're actually harvesting right now,
we're
right?
Actually harvesting right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you picked a busy time of the year to
get
the road.
It was an early harvest, I'll say that. We are farming and producing wines out of Oregon.
Copper Cane says they're farming and producing wines out of Oregon when, in fact, they're taking Oregon grapes, freezing them, carrying them across the border, and producing wines in Oregon. Excuse me, in California. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, colleagues, Oregon and Oregonians have produced a product and a reputation that we can be very proud of. And they have created market demand that apparently somebody thinks is worth trying to steal from us, which means that we as a legislature need to stand up and protect that market share and that industry that I know we're all so very proud of. I'm going to say that a little bit differently because I appeared before the OLCC a little while ago, and at the conclusion of my presentation, the chairperson of the commission turned and said, lies have consequences. And I think that's absolutely true. That's what we're dealing with here. But rather than go on, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Director Marks to talk a little bit more about what OLCC has done, and then to Mr. Jim Burnow, who's going to outline some of the legislative proactive steps that we might consider here in Oregon in the coming months. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Vice Chair Brock Smith and Chairman Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Marks. I'm the Executive Director of OLCC. Just to preface, when I talked to you last, we hadn't entered a process, so I'm here today to sort of talk about the process that we're in, how our administrative process works, what rights Copper Cane has in that process, and what the charges are that we've brought forward. So I'll be very to the point. I have legal counsel here if you have some questions on the particular charges to make sure that I can be as transparent as possible, but given our role in the process, I need to be on point. So with that, for the record, I'm Steve Marks, the Executive Director. I've been asked today to describe the administrative charges made against Copper Cane for the violations of Oregon liquor law with respect to the sales and marketing practices in Oregon. You can appreciate this is a sensitive matter for the commission. I don't want to compromise our case or the protections of due process for Copper Cane. What I can do today is describe the administrative charges and the administrative process that we're moving forward with. At the outset, this is not a usual case for the OLCC. We do not have very many approval of labels cases, and we don't do that as a regular part of our business. The OLCC fully recognizes that the issues involved here in this case encompass a larger national issues of commerce. And I know the committee recognizes that OLCC's authority under Oregon laws, rules, are applicable to activities within Oregon. The OLCC can administratively hold permittees and licensees accountable for lawfully exercising the privileges allowed by their permits and licenses within Oregon. In the summer of 2018, the OLCC received a complaint from industry about deceptively labeled wine manufactured by Copper Cane. The OLCC immediately investigated the complaint, determined that Copper Cane had violated Oregon labeling and advertising laws, and in November of 2018, issued a notice to Copper Cane that the commission was proposing to revoke their certificate of approval. The CERA, as it's called, are issued by OLCC, and the CERA allows the holder to ship wine in the state to be distributed and sold in Oregon. During the same time period, the Alcohol, Tobacco, Tax, and Trade Bureau, TTB, also engaged in parallel work with respect to the wine content issues and those of labeling and advertising. My understanding is that Copper Cane surrendered specific wine labels to TTB, and TTB has provided approvals for new labels in the sell-through that Chairman Gomberg referred to. Commission staff are evaluating these new labels and the case markings as well to determine if they are in compliance with Oregon's labeling requirements. So to briefly summarize, OLCC has charged Copper Cane LLCC with violating cited laws and rules of the state of Oregon, OLCC, and the federal law by, one, identifying the Willamette Valley, Umpqua Valley, and Rogue Valley AVAs on wine labels when the wine is not fully furnished within the state of Oregon. This is a violation of federal regulations, which all wine manufacturers are required to follow. And by identifying the same three AVAs on labels, shipping containers, and cartons, which are used for retail display. This is a violation of federal regulations that allow the AVA to be identified only if at least 85% of the grapes are from that AVA. It is impossible to identify more than one AVA under this law. So by virtue of that, this is a violation. And by using the name Willamette when the wine is not fully finished in Oregon, because the name infers that the wine is from the Willamette Valley AVA. The OLCC has alleged that the wine in the bottles is not, has not alleged that the wine in the bottles is not Oregon wine or is not the claimed varietal. This is not a matter that the OLCC had sufficient evidence to pursue. As a matter of understanding, the charges that the OLCC ultimately brings to hearing could change. Any amendment to the charges would be a public document. It's important that for the committee and industry to understand that Copper Cane LLCC has due process protections under the Administrative Procedures Act, and that unless if it's not contested or otherwise settled, they have rights to a hearing, and the OLCC has to prove its case before an administrative law judge. Copper Cane has now requested a contested case hearing. The OLCC commission can choose, and then the commission, after the hearing process, can choose to amend an ALJ's proposed order to the commission, and must do so within the evidence presented within the ALJ, the hearings process before the ALJ. It's a contested case. Our commissioners are limited by ex parte contacts, and Then after that point, when the commission makes its determination, it issues its final order. Importantly, at any time prior to or during the contested case process, the parties may enter into a settlement agreement, which is ratified by the commissioners at a commission meeting. Also, the licensee or permit holder may exercise all privileges during the contested case process, and they have evoked themselves of asking for that hearing process. There have been questions about how long the process takes. It varies, but if I were, if it went straight to hearing without any intervening discussions, I would put it at 6 to 9 months for the hearing and to conclude commission action. Of course, if there's protective settlement discussions or that take place for time and those might fail, this window of time that it's under consideration by OLCC could be longer. I would note that the vast majority of OLCC cases are settled and that the maximum fine per violation in Oregon law is $5,000. And with that, I want to convey to you in the wine industry that the OLCC does understand the importance of our role in protecting the industry and will uphold our responsibility to do that under the laws and rules of Oregon. We're fully engaged in efforts of the industry to craft new Oregon standards for labeling of wine production here in Oregon. And at the same time, I do believe Oregon and U.S. wine and the U.S. wine industry, the states, the state of Oregon, should all comment on TTB's announced rulemaking, and it's quite broad, that encompasses wine labeling. Important issues of commerce are obviously at stake here for the nation and for Oregon in particular, and the industry participants should have a clear, well-understood market regulation that ensures the importance of AVA designation in the regional identification of winemaking and labeling of wine products. Thank you very much.
Chair, members, my name is Jim Bruno. I'm the founder and CEO of Willamette Valley Vineyards, and I'm here today to update you on proposals that the industry is developing for this next legislative session. I want to thank Representative Gomberg for his leadership, for the members, for their support of our industry. I also want to thank Executive Director Steve Marks. When we brought this issue to him, he immediately organized his staff to begin investigating the matter. I also want to thank the Commission Chair and the members of the Commission who have been very engaged in understanding this issue. Among the ideas that Executive Director Marks gave us was to seek new statutory authority that would allow the OLCC and the DOJ to enter into bilateral agreements with other Oregon, with other wine-producing states for reciprocal enforcement of wine labeling, packaging, advertising, and tax laws. As you can see, the OLCC is limited by what they can do because this producer is outside the bounds of the state of Oregon, even though they're using, in a sense, the state's property, our brands, and the name Brand Oregon. We'll be asking that the laws be strengthened by requiring the representations of geographic origins of wine grapes be accurate. The reason is that fictitious branding, like you see the Oregon coast, masquerading as American viticultural areas actually devalues the real ones. And it misleads and confuses consumers. Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act and the OLCC administrative rules prohibit these type of misrepresentations, and yet here we are. So we believe that new Oregon statutes will make this an even stronger statement. This new statute would also require representations of Oregon AVAs to be truthful and according to the requirements of the law. The case box that Representative Gomberg has shown you is illegal under federal and state law, and a new statute would make it clear, especially when we'll be asking that the violations of wine branding, labeling, and wine standards established by statute or by OLCC rule be a specific violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Another example of a legal reference of an Oregon AVA is in the wine brand Willameter. Although this deception is illegal under federal and state law today. The OLCC just gave Coppercane a new label, Cola, allowing them to continue its use as long as they put made in California underneath the use of an Oregon AVA. That's actually in violation of federal law today. We're asking that the OLCC do what the TTB has failed to do and to hold them to account for what the law actually says. The problem is this endangers all those producers that use the Willamette Valley AVA on their labels here in Oregon. We're asking, there may be legislative proposals that create a mechanism inside the OLCC to increase and revise AVA and variety content on labels. There will be a specific statutory language proposed for higher standards of content from members of the Willamette Valley Wineries Association, and some of you may have heard from them. They were in the Capitol yesterday. Our Oregon standards are the highest in the nation, 95% when the AVA is stated and or inferred, and 90% when Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, for example, as varieties, are used on the label. When the wine carries the brand Oregon, it must be 100% Oregon wine content. And what we're asking is we're asking for statutory language that any out-of-state producers that use our brands represent annually under penalty of perjury that the geographically branded wines with Oregon representations be accurate and stiff penalties be applied when they are not. Think about what you just heard from Executive Director Marks, a $5,000 penalty for a $30 million fraud. Approximately $25 to $30 million of this wine has been sold into the national market fraudulently. We are very concerned about the winemaking practices that are legal in California but are not legal in Oregon. For example, it's legal in California to use a concentrate made from a California grape that dyes the wine, the Pinot Noir, darker and gives it more thickness in its taste. So for pennies on the case, a California winemaker can make what appears to be a high-quality wine when we as Oregon wine growers spend thousands of dollars in our vineyards, leaf pulling, shoot positioning, cluster thinning, to give our wines concentration and flavor. If this is kind of thing can happen, we will not have an Oregon wine industry that is in the national market of that $15 to $30 a bottle over the long term, because we simply cannot compete with unlawful behavior that can occur in California. Now, the industry and the OLCC and the Oregon Congressional Delegation have all asked the TTB to conduct physical field audits to test to see if the wines actually meet Oregon's standards. We don't know if that process has begun, but we certainly hope it does. The state has, since we can't project ourselves into discover what's actually occurring in those California wineries. You know, the awareness of Oregon wine quality, as well as the quality winemaking and grape growing, have been financially supported by the Oregon taxpayer over a number of years, since 1983. And private investment has also been made that has raised the value of Oregon as a brand and our AVAs as a brand, which has invited this kind of fraud. Now, a portion of those funds were established by the legislature in 1983 as a $25 tax on wine grapes that wineries and grape growers pay. Coppercane, for example, given the total value of their Oregon grape purchases by making their wine in California, has avoided about $200,000 in wine grape tax. Now, I know it was no intention upon the legislators to make Oregon wineries pay a tax and let the California wineries who are using our branding and are the benefits of our industry avoid the tax. But this amount of money is actually greater that they're saving than the annual budgets of a number of Oregon wineries comparable in those volumes. It's a significant economic disadvantage. So we're asking the Oregon legislature to fix that in the statute. We're also asking that the OLCC be given additional penalty provisions that mirror what's available to the Department of Justice for violations that for violations up to $25,000 per occurrence, and to double the great tax owed to secure compliance from out-of-state wineries. We also would like the legislature to consider depriving wineries who violate our geographic designations on over multiple periods of time to deny them the privilege of using the Oregon brand on their labels. We're also asking that the these laws be studied by the OLCC with a report back to the interim committee by the year no later than the year 2026 with recommendations to improve compliance, including the possibility that the legislature may require that all wines carrying the Oregon brand be made in the state of Oregon so that the OLCC can properly supervise them. Now, this is just a possibility, something we'd like to consider depending upon what level of compliance can be achieved by the statutes we're asking you to pass this session. We're concerned that the Oregon's multi-billion dollar industry is at great risk because our Oregon liquor law enforcement and tax collection lacks the resources to be effective in staffing and funding their efforts. So we're going to be working with the OLCC to see if we can identify what additional staffing resources and funds that they need to protect an over $5 billion industry that you have seen growing up over this last 50 years. We're also concerned about the Oregon Wine Board and the resources that they have. Their resources were established in 1983, a 2-cent excise tax on the sale of wine in Oregon and a $25 wine grape tax. That was established in 1983. The purchasing power is less than half today, which might gives you an indication of why what we have not been able to have the resources to pursue these issues earlier. So we are concerned about that, and we're asking for, the industry is asking for consideration about what to do about that. Anyway, those are just some of the broad strokes. We really appreciate the support you've given us, and we look forward to working with you this session.
Colleagues, any questions?
Mr. Marks, a couple questions for you. I saw you flinch when there was mention of review of the label and approval of a label that says made in California underneath Willamette here. Do you want to comment on that?
Oh, I think Jim just referenced TTB or OLCC when he should have referenced TTB at that particular point.
Okay.
You got it right, ultimately, when you went through, but you said OLCC had approved the new label, and he meant to say TTB.
I'm sorry, I misspoke.
Yeah.
Well, another question, follow-up. So the certificate of approval that you're that's being contested now in front of the administrative law judge, does that affect the million bottles that we know already in circulation?
It would only affect their future permitting under their or their shipping under the permit that we are proposing to revoke. So it's the specific privilege for them to be able to bring their wines manufactured into Oregon.
So it's a future action. So in the meantime, is there anything that we can do about the million bottles that are already out there?
So I don't want to characterize how many bottles are out there because it's something that's a matter
of
our hearing. But for those bottles, my understanding it would be that there are bottles in the national market. There is nothing that would affect that by Oregon's action.
So just to be perfectly clear, is there anything that Oregon could do to keep those bottles out of our own market?
We need to be able to go through the hearings process to do something about it to keep them out of our own market. We need to go through the process to be able to revoke their permit.
Bought off 6 to 9 months for a at the cost of $5,000 for the privilege of selling some unknown number of bottles of wine.
I will try to get you the established numbers of bottles of wine that we know are, I believe, are in the distributor level in Oregon. We do not have a count on the retail level within Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jim, thanks for coming. Director Marks, thanks for coming. Representative Gomberg, thank you for bringing this to our attention back in September, whenever it was. Because the more I read about it and the more I looked into it, the more outraged I became. And I don't get outraged very often. I'm not a lawyer, but I watch a lot of Law and Order. So I want to point out from that video, which I saw an earlier version of it, as you showed on the wines out of Oregon statement, would appear to me to be under Oregon law, theft by deception. And I've been looking at, and I copied them, Oregon's penalties for that. So this is kind of a question for you, Representative Gomberg. It sounds to me like the amount of wine that Joe Wagner, by his own admission, has sold in Oregon could potentially have exceeded $10,000, would you say?
I would think so, yes.
If I go on,
please.
If it's over $10,000, that would be considered by Oregon law aggravated theft in the first degree. One classification of theft committed under Oregon law is with the intent to deprive the rightful owner of his or her property. That is committing theft by deception. And like most other states, Oregon classifies theft offenses according to the value of the property that is taken, and sometimes by the circumstances surrounding the theft. If the total value of the property stolen is $10,000 or more, Oregon law designates a theft offense as aggravated theft in the first degree, which is a Class B felony, and this is my favorite part. The punishment for aggravated theft in the first degree in Oregon is 10 years in Oregon State Prison and a fine not to exceed $250,000. Mr. Wagner, if he happens to be listening, Mr. Wagner, you've sold more than $10,000 worth of your wine here, and that is, from what I can see, aggravated theft in the first degree. And we don't take that lightly in Oregon. Sorry, that's not a question, but it's a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Post, I too am not an attorney, but I like the way you think. We have heard from the TTB. We have heard from the OLCC. There is also an investigation pending before our Oregon Department of Justice, where they have a lot of lawyers. And I am looking forward to their addressment of this issue as well, and the question of consumer fraud, which is specifically the question that was presented to them.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. This is for Mr. Bernal. If this, getting to damages, you know, it's hard for us to assess completely the damage on our entire industry. If this was a trademark or a copyright infringement between two private parties, there would be the possibility of civil suit with damages. And can you help us understand your perspective on the damage that this one action has done to your winery and the wineries in the Willamette Valley? And I don't know whether you can put a value on that, but or not. Maybe you've done some thinking about that. If there are some values you have in mind, I think it'd help us, because this gets abstracted. We know that our state agencies and our federal agencies have only certain powers, and those powers are really related to deterrence of future wrongdoing. And that does not help us understand what's happened economically to you and your brother and sister industry participants. And I think knowing the magnitude of that would really help our committee.
Vice Chair, members, thank you for the question. I'll do my best to answer. The rise of the Eluan Pinot Noir and Rosé to the number one Oregon branded position for Pinot Noir is over $70 a bottle, and Rosé is over $13 a bottle in the nation, has stolen market share from law-abiding Oregon producers. And so there has been an actual quantifiable reduction in sales of those wineries, and also a reduction in the percentage of market share, which can be measured. We estimate that the volumes of retail sales of wines so misrepresented could range up to $30 million. And so that if you so that would probably create your universe for how much market was there. The one of the things that's happened here is that there's been deception used in the nature of the product. The if it truly is made from 100% Oregon wine grapes, it can only be labeled Oregon. But instead, they've used the AVAs. And so an AVA labeled average wine sale in the retail market of a Willamette Valley AVA Pinot Noir is about $26.04 on average in the national retail market. The Oregon labeled Pinot Noir ranges are in around that $14 to $15 on average. And so the difference is what we could actually quantify. You actually say, well, you improperly and legally used the Willamette Valley AVA to represent products that were only lawfully allowed to use the Oregon. You could actually use the spread between that. And so the real, one of the reasons that the sales have risen so rapidly is that he's used the AVA but put it on sale. So the, on discount. And so the average AVA of a Willamette Valley Pinot Noir is $26. He's selling the LU1 labeled, branded Willamette Valley, you know, wine at just under $20, which is a hot price point. So he's gone between the two price points, and which just helps explain why the rapid rise in the sale of his wine and the loss of our market share. A great question, thank you. Just the difference in profitability on the value of his FOB sales, what they call free on board sales to distributors, it approximates around $3 to $4 million for every 100,000 cases. So that's the benefit he's receiving above labeling it Oregon in revenues from his distributor.
Well, I want to thank you, Representative, for bringing this issue forward. I have a number of wineries in my district, as you know, and I enjoy them all, sometimes more often than not. And I also want to thank you, Director, for all of your diligence in getting on this issue as quickly as you have. And to all of the wineries, this Solidarity Vintage is, again, as you so eloquently stated earlier, Representative, is really the Oregon way. And it's just fantastic to learn more about this. And so thank you to all the wineries as well.
Thank you, committee members, and everyone else. We now return you to your regularly scheduled committee chair. And I apologize that we ran a little bit over schedule with this first item, but I think it was certainly an item of intense interest to the committee and to the people that are here in the audience. I'd like to move now to the subject of urban renewal. And I...
I've done it once, so...
I'm sorry?
We're doing all of them.
All four, yes. So I wanted to invite the chief up, Mr. Landauer, Mr. Douglas, and Ms. Porsche. You are welcome to proceed in any order you prefer.
Good morning, Chair Gomberg and Vice Chair Brocksmith. Thank you so much for having us. I'm Kate Porsche. I currently serve as the Economic Development Officer for the City of Corvallis, but I've been an urban renewal practitioner for over 12 years in three different communities in the state of Oregon. And so we are here today, sort of jointly today, to talk to you about this bill that's upcoming. I wanted to share with you briefly, though, about urban renewal in the state of Oregon. We've got this nice map that has been put together from a consultant that does a lot of urban renewal work around the state, but wanted to let you know that there are over 110 urban renewal districts throughout the state of Oregon in communities large and small, from Portland to Phoenix and Talent, even to John Day. And our communities in Oregon are using this important tool to deliver on their local priorities. Priorities like creating affordable housing opportunities, priorities like infrastructure and job growth. It was kind of neat. Over the summertime, the League of Oregon Cities had a session related to urban renewal specifically, and spent some of that time to talk about how urban renewal districts in Oregon have focused those funds on creating affordable housing opportunities. And we got to hear from communities like John Day, Coos Bay, Wilsonville, Albany, and it was a great sharing of information. When we talk about urban renewal, though, of course, we got to talk about the cost of urban renewal and where it comes from. And urban renewal is funded, as you may know, through increases in assessed value in a given area for a specific amount of time. But it's the taxing districts themselves, our partners at the taxing districts, who are foregoing that revenue for a finite amount of time for the purpose of funding these various projects. The idea here is that at the end of the duration of the urban renewal district period, there's not just going to be safer transportation networks, increased affordable housing opportunities, job growth, but also an increase in the tax base, right? But we're here with our partners today to give you a little background and talk to you about the collaborative work that we've done over the last couple of years to bring forth this bill collaboratively together. So with that, I'll turn it over to my partner, Mr. Mark Landauer.
I guess I'll go ahead. Thank you, Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee. I, at the outset, want to thank you for your indulgence in allowing us to continue this discussion from last short session. You may recall we had a hearing on this topic, and that's sort of laid the foundation for where we are today. I've been asked with for giving you a little bit of a historical perspective on urban renewal, and regrettably, I think that that may be a sign that, that my career is getting a little bit long in the tooth. In 2009, then-Speaker Dave Hunt directed a group of individuals to begin meeting to discuss urban renewal. And at that time, the speaker effectively told all the stakeholders, if you don't address urban renewal in a collaborative manner, the Legislative Assembly will do it. That was a very clear message to all of us, needless to say, that we needed to have some dialogue. And we did so in a very compressed amount of time during the 2000 session. And I should mention who those stakeholders were. Those stakeholders included the cities, the counties, school boards, individual school districts, the special districts, fire chiefs, and a few others. But it was a pretty large table. And as we moved through the discussion, we centered on an issue that, that really was perplexing to a number of us, and that was the seemingly endless life of urban renewal districts. The challenge for us at that time was that many of the overlapping taxing jurisdictions were very concerned that the sponsoring entities would simply amend the urban renewal and effectively increase the maximum indebtedness, thereby making an urban renewal district last for longer than it was originally at least intended at the beginning of the projects. So we worked very hard over that course of a number of months, and ultimately a bill was introduced, House Bill 3056, that ultimately was enacted virtually unanimously in both chambers. Broadly speaking, that bill did about four things. It placed a limit on the amount of indebtedness a sponsor could incur depending on the total assessed value of the sponsoring jurisdiction. It required the concurrence of at least 75% of the overlapping taxing jurisdictions based on the taxes divided in the previous year for substantial plan amendments that increased the maximum indebtedness by more than 20% of the plan's original maximum indebtedness. For those urban renewal districts that experienced very rapid growth, we created a mechanism for the sponsor not to collect the full amount of property tax dedicated to servicing the debt, thereby allowing overlapping taxing jurisdictions to receive some benefit of the unexpected growth. And we also established a mechanism for the assessor to release assessed value to overlapping taxing jurisdictions using both time-based and performance-based measures. Along with these changes included an agreement amongst all the parties not to pursue any legislative changes to urban renewal for essentially a 7-year period without the consent of the members under the signed memorandum of understanding. And we abided by that agreement, which I might add ultimately expired in January of 2017. That agreement also included the creation of an urban renewal oversight committee, and I think what we all sort of agree is that we've reconvened that urban renewal oversight committee at your direction. Since then, we've had a very productive and cordial discussion with our partners, and as you will note, you have LC 1005 before you. I will tell you, we believe that the proposal before you incentivizes additional collaboration, but that collaboration is now under LC 1005 at the beginning of the urban renewal discussion. As I mentioned previously, the legislation in 2009 really focused at the tail end of urban renewal, which typically is about a 20-year period until you get to that end of urban renewal. So we know that 2009 bill incentivized and promoted communication at the tail end, and we believe that this bill, although it's not a panacea and it doesn't address all the concerns of all the parties, it does promote communication, collaboration, transparency, and partnership amongst all the government entities, which we believe will build confidence not only with the governmental partners, but with the citizens that we all serve. So thank you very much.
Landauer.
Good morning, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Justin Douglas. I'm the policy manager for Prosper Portland. If you don't recognize that name, Prosper Portland is the relatively new name for the Portland Development Commission, which is the City of Portland's economic development and redevelopment agency. But today I'm here as a representative of the Oregon Economic Development Association, which is the statewide association that represents economic development organizations. And I chair the Urban Renewal Committee, which is focused on working with our members on urban renewal issues across the state. The Urban Renewal Committee used to live within an organization called the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. We have since merged with OEDA, acknowledging that the missions of AORA and OEDA are really complementary in affecting positive job change and growth for our communities. So just really briefly, I wanted to talk about the four changes that are in this current draft legislation at a high level. The first is that the legislation would clarify the language that is sent out to residents in a community when there is a new or amended district, and it clarifies when a new or amended district may impact property taxes. The second is it clarifies the cap that urban renewal agencies are allowed to add acreage to their districts. There's currently a 20% cap that's an existing statute. We just want to be clear that agencies commit to that 20% cap and that they can't reduce their acreage and then add more acreage that would go over that original 20%. So that's a clarification. The third is really intended to ensure that there is rigor in the annual reporting that urban renewal agencies do, and it would require that urban renewal agencies who already are required to complete annual reports, that they report on the status of maximum indebtedness for each of the districts within their community, and that's basically the amount of debt that they can borrow. And it also requires them to ensure that those annual reports are delivered to all of the affected tax jurisdictions, and that the urban renewal agencies just make themselves available for any questions or concerns that the affected jurisdictions might have. And then the fourth is probably the most substantive of the changes, and that is related to providing some more clarity on when urban renewal agencies should go out and get the concurrence of affected taxing jurisdictions if their new or amended plans include public buildings or basically public art. And there's a nice description within the bill. The public buildings would include things like fire stations, libraries, city halls. And these are projects that I think our partners feel could be funded through other sources besides urban renewal. So the legislation contemplates that urban renewal agencies, if they're considering a project like that, simply confer with the affected taxing jurisdictions and to get their feedback on that. I will mention two things. I think we will have two amendments that will be introduced at one point. The first of which is also regarding the amount of what are considered minor amendments are amendments to urban renewal districts that are less than 1% of the original acreage. We want to clarify that agencies cannot process multiple 1% amendments that ultimately add up to 10% of the district, but rather that it's a cumulative total, and we just didn't get that into the current bill in time. And then we also have a little bit of work to do on the water and wastewater language in the statute, just to clarify how there might be a proportionality associated with those facilities that are either within or outside of a new urban renewal area. So we're still working through some of those details and expect to button that up within the next couple of weeks. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chief Dyke.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dyke. I'm the fire chief for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. We serve 11 cities and 4 counties and tend to interact with a lot of different urban renewal districts. In fact, probably around a dozen right now. This process that the Urban Renewal Oversight Committee had, which we like to refer to as UROC, is we did meet for over a year, and that was after we had a series of meetings with members of the legislature on this topic. The overall theme of our discussions was really focused at creating increased clarity, better communication within those urban renewal districts with all the overlapping players. All overlapping taxing districts are really partners in economic development, and the initiatives and the relationships that we're working on last decades. And we need to get started off on the right foot. There are many great examples of this working well across the state that we did discuss, and my partners at the podium have highlighted those in best practice documents that are being shared with cities and counties across the state that are considering the use of urban renewal. Our goals during these meetings were focused around maintaining the economic development tool and at the same time create more transparency, communication, and the process. We added more process where process makes sense. I believe the legislation that we have drafted drives at those goals. Our process that we did undertake was a good one. I believe we have a much better understanding of each other's issues. In addition to our committee meetings, we attended statewide conferences that were referenced during the testimony today, sharing best practices in the use of urban renewal, how to create a collaborative process in doing so, and I'm encouraged by the process and where we're headed, and I thank you for the opportunity to share all of this information today. And with that, I'd entertain any questions for myself or any of the other presenters.
Thank you. Questions on this subject, colleagues?
Well, I don't see any questions. I want to thank you for your long work on this subject. I want to thank you for your presentation today. Chief Dyke, in particular, thanks to you and the men and women that work with you for all the good work that you do out on the street every day. So I appreciate your presentation today. We will look to this measure as we move forward. Thank you all.
Well, let's talk about broadband and the work of our advisory council. I want to invite Mr.
Fresnel, Mr. Tamarin, and Ms. Riley Ralphs to the podium.
for me?
It might just be these two.
Well, I think we're one short.
All right. Thank you for your patience.
The wine thing was fascinating, so I'm actually glad I got to hear that.
Us as well.
Chair Gomberg, Vice Chair Marsh, Vice Chair Brock Smith, and you use both names, right?
Okay.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Fresnel. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council. I'm also the general manager and chief executive officer of Eastern Oregon Telecom, a rural competitive telephone company and internet service provider. I have with me today Chris Tamron, who staffs the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council. I will tell you that the chairman is just a figurehead. Chris does all the work, so that's why he's here, is to back me up. We also have another member of the
model here.
Wise man. We also have another member of the council. Representative Marsh is the House appointee to the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council. And if you don't know, she has been remarkably engaged, and so we're glad to have her on the council as well. See if I can steer this thing. As you can see on this first slide, the National Broadband Plan rightly speaks of broadband as an essential service, but it is more than that. It is meta infrastructure, and the definition of that is it enhances other infrastructure such as power grids, transportation systems, and the emerging Internet of Things, which is things talking to each other without human intervention. That's the Internet of Things. It's our state's policy to promote broadband adoption and utilization and to reduce the digital divide. To help with this, the Oregon, and I'm going through these really fast, so if I go too quickly on one of these slides, slow me down and I'll back up to it. So to help with this, the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council was created in the 2009 legislative session to help ensure the implementation of statewide broadband strategies. The mission of the council is to encourage coordination and collaboration between organizations and economic sectors, leverage the development and utilization of broadband for education, workforce development, government and healthcare, promote broadband adoption by citizens and communities. And the council is made up of representatives, and this is in the statute, so we don't get to pick categories. The statute actually defines that the council be made up of representatives from cities, counties, telecommunications service providers, tribes, educators, economic development organizations, public safety agencies, healthcare providers, e-government, the Public Utility Commission, and then the State House of Representatives and the State Senate. Members of the council are appointed by the governor, the Speaker of the House, and the President of the Senate. On April 13th of this year, the FCC released its 20th Universal Service Monitoring Report. It showed that, and these are great statistics, so see, I put this in because it's not all bad news. There are some great statistics here. Oregon's internet adoption rate was 84.9% compared to a national average of 81.4%. A recent global study of download speeds showed that the U.S. ranked 20th with an average download speed of 25.86 megabits per second, but Oregon ranked 10th against countries worldwide. So if we were a country, which we could advocate for, Oregon would rank 10th against countries worldwide with an average download speed of 32.16 megabits per second, despite it being a Western state, large terrain, relatively small population. This first map shows the number of broadband service providers throughout the state and illustrates wide coverage and broadband availability. Now, there's a caveat. The problem and the ongoing challenge, however, is that the definition of broadband is a moving target. You remember a few years ago, the definition was 10 megabits by download by 1 megabit upload. The current definition is 25 by 3, so 25 megabits download by 3 megabits upload and above. The second map shows a little bit of a different picture. So this is broadband coverage in Oregon that meets that minimum definition or more, the current FCC broadband standard. So the picture is not as good. So while we have lots of competitors out there, not all of them are providing broadband speed at a minimum of 25x3. On November 1st, 2018, this year, Broadband in Oregon, a report of the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council, was submitted to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, and individually to all members of the Legislative Assembly for the 80th Legislative Assembly in accordance with ORS 285A.070, Section 4. I think you all have copies of that. The report was also submitted to the Office of the Governor and will be posted on the council website. We're working through some issues on ADA compliance for the posting of the report because it's a big report. That report and previous reports, the website address or URL is broadband-oregon.org. So this is our fifth report to the legislature, and it's a wealth of information. Arguably, I believe it's one of the best reports on broadband that is produced anywhere in the United States. However, it's pretty thick, so I recommend at a minimum just reviewing the executive summary and recommendations sections of the report. There's some conclusions at the end, and if anything is triggered as you read through that, you can go back and look at the detail that's supported. I'll do my best to hit the highlights of those sections for you today. You see them on the screen. The first is challenge is digital inclusion, and that refers to activities necessary to ensure that all individuals and communities, including the most disadvantaged, have access to and use of information and communications technologies needed for full participation in our society, democracy, and economy. We've all heard that a rising tide lifts all ships. If we're to realize our potential as a state, we must ensure that all citizens can access reliable and affordable broadband. The next one being cybersecurity. I think most of us are hyper aware of that. If you're not already, you should be. The security of data and communication systems continues to be a critical risk exposure for government, public organizations, private sector businesses, and for individuals that is widely unrecognized and undermanaged. Now, last year, again, to celebrate, Senate Bill 90 established the Center for Cybersecurity Excellence within the Office of the State CIO and the Oregon Cybersecurity Advisory Council. So that's a big win for us that we established that, and congratulations to the legislature. Some of the key trends in this area that still need attention are we have a talent gap in Oregon. So, excuse me. There's a need for cybersecurity expertise. It's interesting when people ask me about why I work so hard to bring really good broadband to the service territory in Eastern Oregon. One of the things that I've told them is, well, when my daughter went away to college, I wanted her to come back. Cybersecurity is the same thing. We have that same challenge. We have, because we were slow to establish a Center for Cybersecurity Excellence in our state, and our university system was a little slow to begin, and we're doing that now. So we've had talent leave to go get educated elsewhere and then not necessarily come back. So we're taking the right steps, but we still have a talent gap here in Oregon. There's a growth of cybersecurity attacks, and as we've been briefed on this issue at the council, we've come to realize that hackers have become businesses, so it's no longer some kid, generally speaking, sitting in their basement. This is a big enterprise, and the hackers are better equipped, better funded, and often better organized than their targets. Hackers are using automation, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. And growth of the cloud is becoming more of a risk area, as 97% of all businesses have some or all of their IT infrastructure in the cloud. which makes us more vulnerable. Next, education. In February 2018, it was estimated, and this is a statistic that I know Representative Marsh was particularly interested in me sharing. It was estimated there were still 43 school districts and charter schools in Oregon without access to high-speed internet. That still hurts my brain. After all the work that we've done in this area, we still have a pretty big gap to deal with. And it's not just the current access, it's the growing need for broadband access in our schools. So there are thresholds that have been established for minimum connectivity per school district. For small school districts, fewer than 1,000 students, the 2017-18 targets are at least 1.5 megabits per user with a minimum of 100 meg for the district. Medium-sized school districts, 3,000 students, they're looking for at least a gigabit per 1,000 users. So if it's a 3,000 student school, they would need a minimum of 3 gigabits to that school. And then large school districts, more than 10,000, at least 0.7 gigabits per second per 1,000 users, but it scales bigger. So those numbers triple on average in school year 2020-21. So the need for broadband triples. So even if we were where we need to be at a minimum today, just in a couple of years, we're going to be behind again. So this is an area that we need to continued attention. And I am going to get to recommendations. These are the challenges. I will get to recommendations, I promise. Public safety. There's significant support needed for Oregon's 911 centers, the PSAPs, and first responders to migrate from legacy systems to next generation 911 and to interoperable wireless broadband communication systems. There's a lot going on here, but there's a lot of work to do. About 70% of all incoming 911 calls are now from cell phones. And the issue with that is cell phones don't deliver generally location data. Like your home phone, when you dial, they actually know you're dialing from your home address or your business, a landline. Cell phones don't provide that information, which creates significant challenges for our dispatchers. And then text 911 is becoming much more common. And many of our PSAPs are still not capable of receiving text to 911 messages. So there's upgrades needed there. Right now, we're in the middle of the implementation of FirstNet, which is a national initiative to build a wireless broadband public safety network for first responders across the whole country that's interoperable. And it is underway in Oregon, but there's still work to be done with that, coverage specifically. And for those of you, and I see, you know, folks from the coast and folks from the east side of the state, and the rest of you may even travel out to where I live. There are places where you still can't use your cell phone. So issues with that. Agriculture contributes, and I'm from an agriculturally based area, although data centers is becoming a really nice second big industry in our area. Agriculture contributes more than $8 billion to Oregon's economy every year. And for those of you who don't understand or hadn't heard that number, that is a big number. It's actually $8.25 billion to our state economy every year. And it's emerging as an important driver and application for broadband infrastructure in rural areas of the state. I often talk about one of my customers, and they're a large farm, largest producer of onions in the North American region. Some say they're the largest grower of onions in the world. And their network operations center kind of looks like NASA because they do precision agriculture. Some of the state's largest data capacity customers in rural areas are now in agriculture. And the agricultural sector is becoming a larger growing consumer of technology with increasing needs for bandwidth and access in rural markets. Local community broadband planning. This is one of my favorites. The need for broadband planning is compelling. Research indicates that ubiquitous, affordable broadband access at a minimum of 25.3 is necessary if a community is to be able to improve local business competitiveness, innovation growth, and to ultimately survive in an information-based global digital economy. I've been participating in a broadband strategic planning effort for Boardman, Oregon, and they're having their big plenary session right now, and I'm missing it, so I had to send somebody in my stead. And I'm pleased to see that going on. There are other efforts going on around the state as we speak as well. Leveraging federal funding programs. There's significant funds available through the federal government programs. I think you're going to hear some more about this during this legislative session, primarily through the FCC, the NTIA, and the USDA. And it still, to this day, cracks me up that broadband funding comes through the Department of Agriculture. Most of the programs require matching funds. And then finally, network interconnectivity. Oregon needs to work to raise its level in the internet hierarchy. The internet is not a single managed network, but is rather a network of networks, requiring that data traffic needs to be passed between one or more networks at points of interconnection to move from the sender to receiver. So I was talking at the Oregon Connections Conference about how a 911 call actually may go from a cell phone to one PSAP if it's on a border and have to be transferred long distance, which means it most likely hits the internet to go back down to the next PSAP. And how do we, this network that goes from one network to another and to another, these networks pass this traffic at points of interconnection, and these are peering points. The largest networks, called Tier 1 networks, use these big interconnection points and exist in locations around the U.S. and the world, none of which are in Oregon. So while we have the PITIC, which is our big interconnection point, it's not a Tier 1 peering point. And so we think that there's a big opportunity there on an economic development, from an economic development standpoint, and also from a structure standpoint, to move ourselves further up, which would attract more of those Tier 1 providers here to Oregon. So let's talk about recommendations real quick. The first one is we're recommending that we create an Oregon broadband office. We're one of the few states that doesn't actually have a state broadband office. And while the Broadband Advisory Council has done a really good job, we're limited. You know, we're an advisory council, and so we're limited in some of the things that we can do. So this dedicated state government office could be a tool for creating connections and sharing information among state agencies, broadband service providers, and other stakeholders. Whether as an independent agency within a state agency or in the office of the governor, it's my understanding that there are already discussions about accomplishing this with legislation or even an executive order. We also recommend that we provide state funding. We develop and fund new grant, loan, and loan guarantee programs for broadband infrastructure in unserved areas, and as matching funds for other funding sources. Talked earlier about those federal funds that are coming available. Often they require matching funds. We would leverage federal funding programs through state funding match and technical assistance for eligible Oregon applicants, upgrade state and local government telecommunications networks as a means to expand broadband service to unserved or underserved areas. Infrastructure in unserved and underserved areas. Consider state funding to subsidize broadband costs for low adoption populations and community anchor institutions, similar to the FCC's E-Rate program, Healthcare Connect Fund, and Lifeline programs. Require that broadband infrastructure components such as conduit be included for all state infrastructure funding programs such as roads, bridges, water, and wastewater projects. The highest cost of deploying broadband often is digging a ditch. And so if we have conduit already there, we can greatly reduce the cost of deploying broadband out into areas that need it. We're proposing or recommending that we repurpose the Oregon Universal Service Fund. to fund and improve broadband, not just basic telephone service. So the Oregon Broadband the Oregon Universal Service Fund currently just supports voice products, and we're recommending that it also include broadband. And then we're recommending support for low adoption populations. This is another element of that digital divide that I mentioned early on, providing outreach to low adoption populations through established community institutions, increasing the availability of a